Welcome to This Business of Music and Poetry podcast, where the life of a creative meets the real world. I'm Michael Amade, host of World Poetry Open Mic, The Michael Amade Show, author of more books than I should mention, poet, musician, and above all, creative entrepreneur. My collaborator and conspirator on this project is Clifford Brooks, founder of the Southern Collective Experience, host of Dante's Old South on NPR, poet, the author of The Draw of Broken Eyes and Whirling Metaphysics, Exiles of Eden, and Athena Departs, A Gospel of a Man Apart. Our guest today is poet and author, Melissa Studdard. Melissa is the author of four books, including the poetry collection I Ate the Cosmos for Breakfast and the young adult novel 6 Weeks to Yedia. Her short writings have appeared in a wide variety of journals, magazines, blogs, and anthologies such as the New York Times, Poetry, Psychology Today, The Guardian, New Ohio Review, Harvard Review, Bettering American Poetry, and Poets and Writers. In addition to writing, Melissa serves as the executive producer and host of VITA Voices and Views for VITA Women in Literary Arts and on the Tubb Advisory Council as a Walt Whitman Project Planning Associate. She's a past president of the Associated Writing Program's Women's Caucus. She received her MFA from Sarah Lawrence College and is a professor for the Lone Star College System. So without any further ado, here's our interview with Melissa Studdard.
And tonight we have Melissa Studdard with us, and she is the author of a book of poetry that I am much enamored with called I Ate the Cosmos for Breakfast. Melissa Studdard, how are you doing?
I'm doing very well. How are you?
I am fine and dandy like sour candy. And to get your story started, let's start at the beginning. And let me ask you, what drew you to a vocation in letters?
I think I would have to say that first of all, I love to read and I've always loved to read. But in terms of wanting to tell my own stories and write poems and all of that, I came from a family that was big on storytelling. So whereas another family might be sitting around the Thanksgiving table arguing about politics or that kind of thing, my family was telling stories. And so it's just in my blood. And
where is your happy place? I'm serious. Like, where do you go to kind of escape no matter where you're sitting down? Like, where do you go?
Yeah, that is a great question. I carry a journal and I write in my journal. So, I mean, really writing is my happy place. So, I love it. I'm in love with writing and it makes me happy. And no matter where I am or what I'm doing, I can sit down and write for a little while, put in the earbuds and I'm in my happy place. Everything else is gone and I just write. So I can do it anywhere. I can do it at an airport. I can do it, in the middle of a city, in a park. I mean, not with a bear coming after me. But
right, right. No, that would be the distinct end of Melissa Studdard. What? She was eaten by a bear?
But
no, why was she alone in the woods? With
half a poem in its
in her one hand, this is beautiful poem. Like, damn it, Melissa. It's when you find yourself again, like I think the three best inventions ever were the wheel, air conditioning, and the iPod. I do, because like I'm serious. You put your
notice the printing press wasn't mentioned in there.
Well, I mean, we make do. All right, there's some text here. I just made that joke up on the fly. So that's implied. Anywho, no, it's it. When you're in a public place and listening to music, how much do you people watch? Like when you see a crowd and you see that really old cute couple that's been together forever and the young couple that's just probably on their first date and the difference in their mannerisms, like how much people watching do you do when it's available when you're writing?
Yes, I do a lot. I'm a terrible voyeur.
Me too.
I love to watch people and I'll write about them. I mean, I don't write about them in a way that they would ever know, but part of the journal that I keep. I have a bunch of different journals that I use for different things, but one of the ones that I have, I write on both sides of it. So on one side, it's observations that are just sort of descriptive things that I notice about people. And then the other side is more my musings and things that I think. And for some reason in that one journal, I separate those out. So I could sit there and just, you know, for two pages, just describe the way someone looks. And then I don't really refer back to it in the sense that I would go and draw from it to put those exact words into something else I write, but because I've taken the time to observe it at that level and in that depth, it comes back and resurfaces when I'm writing later.
So as much as your life is surrounded in writing and in poetry, and I think I can speak from this from more of a musical side and being someone who taught music as well, and then also is involved so much in it as well as writing. When your world becomes so filled with that, and there's a lot of professional obligations around it and things, sometimes it can start to feel really stressful, and it's work. And I've noticed that a lot of the people who are very good at it and love what they do have little practices that they use to keep themselves in love with their art form and their discipline. So do you have anything that you do to try to kind of help stoke and keep yourself in love with writing? How does that work for you?
Well, I think probably the primary thing is just reading a lot of other poets and a lot of contemporary poetry. I just am constantly falling in love with it over and over and over every day because I just try to stay in tune with what other people are writing and discover new poets. And if I read something online that I like, and a lot of it can come from social media, if someone tweets or posts on Facebook a poem that I love, I'll go and Google the poet. And then if I love the work, I'll order the book. And then that's a whole new just inspiration that can go for a while. And then there's another one and another one. There are always more great books and writers coming out. So there's no lack of inspiration because of that. And the world is infinitely interesting as well. Just as you mentioned, people watching and going to the park and just watching the trees change colors. And I love trees. I like to climb trees still.
I can completely understand what you're saying. And it reminds me of something I've brought up a few times, which is kind of the idea of choosing to live in a poetic way or choosing to live poetically, where you see inspiration in the world and you purposefully go to places that are really interesting. Like, for instance, I was just up at a meditation thing up in the Rocky Mountains. I'm in Denver right now. So I was just up there. I came back earlier today. But all that stuff is just there to kind of internally spark new things and to always keep things moving for me. And I feel like every one of us on this call have our own versions of that. And so I appreciate you sharing kind of what you're talking about.
Talking of that, and I mean to attack you with this question, but what role does music play in your creative process?
Actually, it plays a huge, huge role in my creative process. I have gotten to where, well, a few different things happened. One is that I've developed a sort of muscle memory that my friend Kelly Russell Agadon and I write together. And she first pointed this out to me, that we both have certain songs that we listen to. And I can be completely just sort of going about my everyday life, doing other things, and then I can put these certain songs on, and boom, I'm totally just ready to write. It doesn't take, because otherwise sometimes it takes some brooding. You have to walk around and brood for like 2 hours just to be able to sit down and write a poem. It may take 30 minutes to write the poem, but it takes 2 hours of brooding. But if I have the right music on, I can reduce the brooding by like 20%. You know?
As a songwriter, I'm so jealous of this.
I feel like there's
songwriting.
There's an equation in there. That's what 20%, the less of the brooding. It's fascinating that you say that, because it's music. It jump starts something, you know. It does, and that muscle memory. I like how you said that the muscle memory, the practice of it seems to also remind you how important that song is to be that immediate.
Right. Yeah. Well, and one other thing is I also dance when I write. So obviously the music is important to the dance. So, and I mean, I literally dance while I write. Like I will sometimes be standing up with the notepad in my hand, writing and dancing. And sometimes I'll be, you see the chair I'm on, I'll be sort of on my feet like a frog, like sort of bouncing up and down like this, like while I'm writing. And sometimes I'll go and dance and then come back and write. And they're all different variations on that, but the dancing and the writing are very much intertwined.
Do you think that do you feel like that is was that something you were doing that was kind of unconscious at the beginning, or was it something that you feel eventually developed as you found your voice?
That's a good question. I think when I was doing it unconsciously, I was doing it possibly badly. Hopefully not the writing, but the dancing. Sure. But I started taking dancing lessons. And yeah, I mean, I started to really realize that it was a part of the process and embrace it. And I also very much realized that for me, at least, and I think for a lot of people in any kind of arts, being inspired by other arts and practicing other arts really feeds the art that we do. So I love looking at paintings. That's another thing I'll do. I'll be writing and then realize like, oh, I feel the need to be visually stimulated. And I'll just right. go get like, I like right here, Remedios Varo, you know, I've got this stuff all around my desk and I can just stop and look at a painting for 20 minutes and then go back to writing or, you know, that kind of thing. So I just want to be surrounded by things that sort of light me.
Well, and this is something that Cliff, we've talked about very briefly, I think, in the beginning episodes of this show, which is about creating not just systems for life and systems for putting work out to the world, but also creating systems for what allows you to be the most creative. And it sounds like, Melissa, that's something you've learned through, you know, through the years of doing this, figuring out, well, if I have these things available to me, then it helps me keep in this creative flow and in this space and helps me be optimal. So I just wanted to point that out for anyone who's been listening, that this is a really good example of that.
Yeah. Well, another important thing for me is community. I try to stay around other creative people as much as possible. And I find that the more time I spend around other creative people, the more inspired I am, because even if you have sort of lost the fire for a little bit, somebody else is running along with that torch and you can relight from them and you're going again. You know, it's a beautiful thing.
That's a good point, actually. I like that too. I think even if it's not a conscious relighting from them, worst case, you kind of get, in a very positive way, you get slightly competitive. You're like, all right, I got to write something that good, you know, just so I can like feel good about, you know. I think that's good stuff.
Oh, that's funny.
I mean, I think that. And what we've talked about it before, and you know, in every other vocation, they call it networking, and what we do is the same. And you know, you've got a good bunch of people when you're, or maybe I'm just talking for me, but maybe this goes par for the course. But you're comfortable, you know. And that may sound silly to say, but when you get around those people that do light your fire that way, like there's a comfort, there's an acceptance, there's a mutual, and of course, going down that rabbit hole made me think about like the subconscious and what is it about us that kind of links up on that creative level. And then I swung back around, Melissa, when you talked about like how you have the journal where on one side you muse and on the other side you have the more analytical, you know, motion and movement of people that you're watching. And from the motion, the different kind of tactile means you use to create. Did you study psychology? Or does that play? Do you make an active role to marry that, because it just seems like there's a practice of going back and forth that's fascinating? Or am I way off? Am I off? I'm close.
No, you're not off. I mean, my minor in college was philosophy, so I've always been right. in philosophy. But as far as psychology goes, I think that comes more from my family. I have several family members who are psychologists and psychiatrists, and as well, my mother, though she's not a psychologist or psychiatrist, could have been. She spends a lot of time analyzing other people, and she's extremely good at it. And so that's another thing that I just really grew up around, hearing people talk in this way all the time. So it's always been an interest of mine. And I think that human beings are utterly fascinating. I don't know. I think most human beings are so fascinating, we don't even fully understand ourselves, much less other people. So that's also sort of an endless supply of interesting fodder.
It's the way your poetry reads to me is of a, it's a, it shows like that clinical fascination. Like there's never judgment. And I think that when you, when, and I mean you, I mean the universal, all of us, when we're writing or writing songs about somebody, or when you're trying to write about a situation, but not anybody in particular, it's hard to skate that line of being objective enough to let other people in while still retaining enough of that passion of why you wrote that song. And I guess, or wrote that poem. When I read what you write, there's always a reverence for the subject matter. And I wonder, like, do you get that eye from your mom? The way that the language spills when it's like I said, I don't know if I'm saying it right, but like it's not a cold way to write either. It's a very clean, crisp, clinical affection for mankind that I read in your work. Is that close to the point?
Yeah, I mean, I think I understand what you're saying, and I want to speak to what you're saying and your question about whether or not that comes from my mom. I think to a certain degree it does come from her, because I think of the many, many conversations that we had about various things that were going on, and her really intensely dogged persistence in trying to figure things out, even sometimes something with me that I no longer even desired to figure out, and she would continue and continue, and I would say, okay, I think I'm done now.
We have moved past this, Mom.
I mean, you know, honestly, when I was going through my divorce, my mom would want to analyze what was going on with my soon-to-be ex-spouse and how this all happened. And we just go on and on and on. And at some point, I just said, Mom, you know what? I'm over it. Let's keep over it. Right? But in terms of what you said that also really interests me about being objective enough to not be judgmental, but still feeling passionate about something. And I feel that that's very, very possible, because it's when you're objective about the aspects that would make you judgmental, it doesn't mean that you have to be objective about other aspects of the person. So you can be very subjective about loving them, embracing them, being fascinated by personality traits, and that can all be very, very subjective. But in terms of whether or not you're going to say you were right or wrong or this is bad or ugly or whatever, you can really turn that part off while the other part is still very much alive. And I think it's also kind of a natural tendency too, because I think that I don't want to be judged by other people, so I don't judge them.
Right. Now, you said that your minor was in philosophy, and when I, in your work and the way you seem to me, the way you view art is there's an ethics to it. And does your philosophy, a personal philosophy, does it utilize ethics throughout even your writing practices? Like the way, and again, it's almost psychoanalytical how you can, and I absolutely can see it, where you can kind of shut one lobe off and have the other one speak and then turn the other one on and speak from the other side of the equation. This astuteness, I guess, is what I'm trying to get at. Is that also philosophic in its basis, the meticulous nature of it, the way you create?
You know, I've never thought about it before. It's interesting. You all were talking earlier about how some things feel very natural. I think you were saying, Michael, that sometimes you don't even know that you're receiving the torch or relighting the torch on someone else. It's just kind of happening. And so I would have to say that I wasn't aware of it, but now that you mention it, it could be that certain logic systems I learned and certain ways of, analytical thinking and those types of things could certainly come into play as structures that I didn't really realize were in place. But now you've got me thinking about it.
Well, it's a complex thing. Yeah. How any of us find the voice. I mean, obviously. So let me ask you this, Melissa. You know, obviously you work with students and this kind of these topics quite a bit. This is something I like to ask for the other poets who might be listening, is what are some of the common, I don't want to say mistakes, but common kind of missteps that that people who want to be poets, when they come to you, seem to be making on a larger level? What is something that you tend to see when you're dealing with new poets?
Yeah, I think the first thing that I see, and I mean, certainly not all new poets do it, but probably the most common issue that I see that I think can actually be kind of easily overcome is that when they first start writing, they feel so strongly about the things that they want to say that they're not patient enough to build the context that makes it meaningful. Mm-hmm. So they want to just sort of come straight out and say, I feel sad. And, I have to say, okay, I'm sorry that you feel sad, but how can you make the reader feel empathy for that instead of just saying like, I'm sorry you feel sad. So then we have to figure out how to step back and be patient enough to not just blurt out exactly what the feelings are. And probably the most difficult part of all of that is that if you have a classroom full of new students, most of them want to do that. So they want to support each other in doing that. So it makes it even harder to get the point across, because I might say something like, okay, well, we really need, I'll start talking about context, or we really need to have some more description here, or this part is a little abstract or vague. And then you'll have another student who will speak up and say, well, I like it like that. And and I say, well, I'm not saying I don't like it. I'm just saying it's not fully doing its job. And let's look at how we can do that. And, I have to sort of teach them to be able to take in the constructive criticism and the critiques in a way that doesn't feel like, I guess I have to sort of train them to understand that we are all trying to make our work better. And it's not about just bringing in something brilliant right off the bat. And what I usually tell them is that when we're in the workshop environment, I ask them to think of each other's works as their nieces and nephews. So like if one person in the class brings in a poem, then everyone else in the class is the aunt and uncle of that poem. And I tell them it's just like if you were with your niece or nephew and you're teaching them softball and how to, stand properly and swing the bat, you would find a way to teach them to do it properly so that they could really do well at the sport. But you would also be very kind and encouraging and say, that's how I want you to be in the classroom, in the workshop. But it takes a little training to get them to be able to do that. I think I've gone off on a tangent here.
No, I think that's very real. I mean, that mm-hmm. the ability to be able to take that kind of constructive feedback and then be able to apply it to your art form is really, I think, what separates the people who end up having some skill in craft and people who don't. I think the myth of someone being just a born amazing poet or born amazing songwriter. I mean, songwriting is the same thing. People could come out and just want to say, I'm sad. But unless you build some sort of a context, unless you use some sort of song form and scaffolding and structure, it doesn't really matter, or it doesn't convey it well anyway. I really think there's so much to go in with that. But I one thing that maybe I, want to throw in and just ask about is, you grew up around storytelling. Mm-hmm. And at what point did it strike you that you wanted to try to focus your professional life around telling stories? Because a lot of people tell stories and then just go become car mechanics or go do whatever. Right. You know what I mean? I know a lot of great fishermen who are storytellers, you know. However, what is it that you think resonated within you that made you kind of realize you wanted to make this your life's work?
I think I've been doing it for about 10 years, and I said, okay.
That's long enough.
Hey, I think I'm doing this. I joked earlier about how I didn't realize that you could be a poet. I also really didn't realize that you could be a fiction writer either. I just didn't think any of that was possible. I didn't come from the people in my family were artistically talented, but they were psychiatrists and lawyers and doctors and accountants and very, very practical people. And nobody would have run off and become a poet, to my knowledge. or if they did, they hid them somewhere. And first of all, I didn't realize that it was a possibility. So when I discovered that I loved language and writing and all of that, the thought was, I know I'll teach English. It didn't occur to me to actually become a writer so much as to teach things that other people had written. I happen to have been fortunate enough to have a few things that I kind of just stumbled into that led me to this. And the first one was that I was in Houston and going to the University of Houston, which has a top creative writing program. So I would be in the halls or in a classroom or standing outside the building talking to someone who was in a creative writing class. And I started to realize, oh, wait, you can actually do this. So that was probably the first step for me. And then I just started writing and sending things out and publishing, and that was the second step. And then I got married and I had a child, and I got really pulled away from all of it. And for probably about 10 years, I didn't write, which, as you two as creative people probably know, that's slightly traumatic because your mind doesn't stop making stuff up and you can think at times that you're crazy, but really you're just writing dialogue in your head because that's what you're meant to do. So I did that for a while, and then it turned out that my daughter loved reading and writing so much, she's just a born writer, that she would, like, I'll give you an example. When she was in preschool and they would have show and tell and all the other kids would bring in a little Barbie or a train or something, she would have me dictate a story for her, and then she would photocopy it and hand it out to the class for show and tell and then give the original to the teacher. So once I realized that this was something that we could do together and that it wasn't going to take me away from her, I started writing again. And the next thing I wrote was actually a middle grade novel. And then there I launched back into poetry.
Okay, I'm going to try to unpack this and not talk like a machine gun, because I'm kind of excited about this. Okay. So you had to walk away from writing for 10 years. That's painful to say, much less do. Yes. And then your daughter ended up having the same propensity for genius that you have. And so that walks you back to it. And you saw when she was so young how it came out naturally. It leads me to ask, do you believe when you're meant to write or you're meant to be any kind of art, there's an innate knowledge of that art, that divine spark that you have, and then honing it and taking classes and learning that it's there and what those things are called is important to hone your craft. But do you think that there's something that creatives are born with, that fire that's specific to them, that cannot be taught?
I don't believe that it cannot be taught, but I do believe that some people are born with it. And I've seen that a lot. I will sometimes, like, I still remember one student I had in a creative writing class who wrote the most brilliant poetry. I mean, everyone in the class was in awe of everything that she wrote. She had this knack for surreal imagery, and just, she had no background in it whatsoever. And at the end of the semester, when I asked her if she was going to go on and take more creative writing classes, she said no, because she was almost done with her cosmetology degree and she really wanted to be a hairdresser. And right. It broke my heart, but that's where she wanted to put her creativity. And I'm sure she was an incredible hairdresser, but it just, you know, she had natural skill. She never developed it. And if she had never developed it and just written for her, the rest of her life with what she already had, she would have been better still than most people. But I also believe that there were a lot of people in that class who learned it from watching her do it and seeing how her mind worked. And some of them are now very, very good the way she was. But that was just because they really wanted it.
See, that's a really interesting thing. I've always kind of been, you hear it time and time again, some talent that doesn't work might be great, but but people who maybe aren't as talented but just work like crazy can do pretty good. But when talent doubles down on the work, that's when you get like the Michael Jordans of things. But one thing I've noticed, and maybe this shows up in poetry, I wanted to see if you see this on a musical level. There are people who are born with musical talent, but a lot of that talent manifests itself in their ability to listen to other people and then be able to pull lessons inherently just by listening to the music of others. So they can listen to Led Zeppelin and suddenly realize, oh, that's why they use these chords this way. Now I have this style completely figured out.
Right.
Do you find that with many of your students, or maybe not many, but do you find that occasionally with your students, people can just read poetry and suddenly go, oh, I've got it now. I know what's going on.
Absolutely. That's absolutely a part of it. And it makes me actually start to question what talent really is, because when I hear you making the distinction between talent and work, I start to wonder. I mean, I had thought of the people who worked hard to learn those things as people who developed talent. Maybe it wasn't inherent, or maybe it was there and it was dormant and it needed to be activated. I don't know, but it just has me sort of wondering now, like, what really is talent? You know, if you work really hard and learn the craft of something and really master it, are you then talented? I don't know.
You know, I'm not sure. It's funny because as you bring that up, I realize I have a different view of talent than even the question I asked, because I remember one of my great teachers mentioned that his definition of talent, the older he got, became more and more less about innate ability and became more about the desire to do something more than eat.
Dude, that's it.
So I think and that's actually the philosophy I go for the reward. So it's funny when you bring that up, I'm like, I don't really think I approach talent even the way I asked that question. But but at the same time, I think maybe innate ability or just kind of inborn manifest ability without training. Maybe that is not the catchy way to say it, but that's a way to say it.
Yeah. Okay. Yes, I'm with you now.
Okay. Thanks for pointing that out.
I mean, I was anyway. I just wasn't. Yeah, I wasn't. I wasn't sure what I thought anymore.
That's our job on this show, is just make everyone question reality by the time we're done.
It is.
Who am I? Why am I here?
Time's an illusion.
None of this means anything. Three adults de-evolve in less than an hour. Melissa, what other cultures influence your writing? Because I mean, I think I see where it comes from, but I want to hear from you. When you talk about dancing, I can kind of see Rumi, but you bring more culture subtly into what you write. Where do you pull that energy from?
Oh, I've never thought about that before. I mean, I'm very interested in culture, and I love to travel. I mean, travel frequently, and I love to study comparative religion. I'm very interested in the mystical aspects of all religions. I love to read things that are from other cultures. And I mean, I was just talking to a friend about this either today or yesterday, I can't remember, about how, you know, when you look into another culture deeply enough, it not only helps you understand that culture, but it helps you understand your own better as well by comparison. And so it defamiliarizes things about your own experience in ways that help you understand and examine it. So I'm a fan of that, yes. And so Rumi, yes, that's true. And I mean, definitely, I think I hear you picking up on the fact that I am interested in both Eastern and Western influences. Yes. And, you know, I went over to India a couple of years ago, and you're right.
It's often your poetry reads like a travel journal. It's a, you know, and in the periphery of that story, prime, you have like kind of what you're reading on the side and what you're eating.
Reading, or is that just me?
Well, it's just, I mean, it's what the reason I say all that is like when you mention eating, is it something that's literally typically like the things going on as I read it, like things that are going on in that moment as you're eating those things, where people often want to find really deep, meaningful symbolism in there is sometimes when you describe details and what you write are the details, just play by play what you're doing in that moment.
I'm sorry, I got stuck on something you were saying.
I'll do that. See, I'll ask seven questions and see which one sticks. But no, what I'm saying is like often when I pick up details in your poetry of like, you know, a travel journal and, you know, what you're having for lunch, and then when you're seeing somebody else, and people that when they're picking apart poetry will see you eating an apple. Just say again, like this example, that it means something else. And what I'm asking is, in your poetry, when you have little details like that, is it often just point of fact that that's actually what you're doing while you're writing that poem?
No. No. Thank you for asking. I think I have a tendency to think in metaphors and analogies. And even when I talked about the torch earlier, that's not anything that I had ever thought of before, or sort of dreamed up or said to anyone else. That's how, where my mind goes when I try to understand something, I compare it to something else. So if you read something that I've written and you think that it's a metaphor for something else, it's likely that you're right. Yeah.
Well, I mean, and the reason I mentioned it is because it's seamless. And again, we come back to that point of objectivity. In your creation of the, and using such natural use of metaphor as detail, how do you flex that muscle? Like, how do you make that walking that fine line so natural?
Thank you. First of all, that's a compliment, so I appreciate that. I mean, I think it has a little bit to do with how each person's mind works. So for me, it kind of is natural, and that's why it seems natural. In fact, when I edit, a lot of times, I know, I forget who it was, but there's a poet who is also a really good teacher who I hear a lot of people talking about, this thing she calls the holiday hand method, where you write the piece and then you go back in and like the little cloves that you would put in the hand, yeah, put in your metaphors and that kind of thing. And for me, it's the opposite. I have to go and pull some of them out in order to make sure that it's not too dense. And so when I'm revising, my big task in revising is to go back and work towards clarity. So maybe that could be the answer. That might be what would make it seem more seamless, is for me to go and make it a little less dense and try to work in, as you said, a little bit of narrative or something else around the metaphor, so that it's not just, you know, here it's comparing this to this and this to this and this to this.
Right, right.
But I think also, a lot of the people who I like to spend time with also speak and think in metaphor. We understand each other and communicate that way. So that helps too for me, because, to a certain extent, we sort of run along with each other's minds, but sometimes you have to stop and explain what you mean, and then you have to learn how to do that, you know?
right.
Well, I think one of the things that I've run into, that I resonate so strongly with what you're saying, is that there'll be times where, and Cliff and I have had conversations like this too, where the conversation entirely takes place on a metaphorical level, And he and I both can understand exactly what's happening, but anybody else sitting there listening would be like, what the hell are they talking about? But the issue is, if someone asks us to explain, we probably explain with more metaphors. And that becomes an issue.
This is true.
I love that. You know, it's interesting. One of the assignments that I used to give frequently to students, but I don't do quite as often anymore because some students had ethical issues with it. Imagine that. I would have them take a notebook and go and sit somewhere and transcribe as literally as possible a conversation of other people that they sort of eavesdropped on. And they didn't have to name the people or publish the conversation or anything. All they had to do was show it to me because I'm nosy. No, I wanted them to learn how people really converse, because when they come into a class, the conversation is often, you were asking things that are problematic, the most stilted dialogue you can imagine. Well, hello, good sir. I am walking into the room now. It's nice to see that you are already in the room. Would you like one of these apples that I have on this tray that I'm holding that is silver? No, good sir. I see that you have a silver tray. However, but you see what I'm talking about.
You're a serial killer.
I was going to say, I want to talk like that for a day and just see what happens.
I know. And I mean, I want to make the point, I'm not making fun of anyone. I mean, right. they all do it. We all do it. Everybody does it when they Absolutely. First sit down to write dialogue. I mean, I have hardly ever seen anyone who doesn't do it. But all you have to do is go and listen to two people talk for a little while, and you realize if you're an outsider listening to two other people talk, you don't know what they're talking about. Sometimes they'll be talking about one thing, and then they could be talking about the weather. And then the next thing you know, they're using pronouns, and they both know who they're talking about. No one has ever said the name or anything, and they're just running with each other. And when people know each other well and their minds work similarly, they can do that, I think. And it's wonderful, you know, and I think as a writer, if you can build that into dialogue, it's very exciting. But I haven't ever heard anyone say it about metaphor before, like you just did.
I would imagine that a lot of people who write, like you're talking about, and, you know, creative people do this quite a bit. And, but I also think it's a beautiful way to kind of see the world. And so one question that kind of came up for me as I was listening to you talk also was, do you have a specific kind of creative process you go through when you know you're going to write? Do you sit in a very specific place? You mentioned that you listen to a lot of the same music. Is there a kind of food you have? Is it a certain time of day? I mean, what is your creative process like?
Yeah, that's good. I definitely have to have a little brooding time, as I mentioned. And I don't know what it is or why. And it doesn't have to be specifically thinking about what I'm going to write, but, I just, you know, I have to have a little bit of time. I mean, I'd say at least 15 or 20 minutes. To just go really inside my own mind, or, you know, I mean, it might not look like that's what I'm doing. I might be vacuuming, but that's what I'm doing. And if I don't do that, then it's difficult for me to write sometimes. And that's one of the things that is interesting about being around or living with other people, is that a lot of times it doesn't look like you're working, but you are really working. And they think you're taking a break, and oh, since you're not doing anything, can you? You're like, I'm in my head, go away.
100%. 100% true.
Thank you,
yes.
Jesus.
Not a,
thank
you. I think we all are having this experience. Yes.
What is wrong with you? Why are you daydreaming? I'm gonna stab you in the face. No, I was. Yes. Okay. Sorry. Yes. I got emotionally attached to that answer. I'm sorry.
Well, to continue the answer, I have a lot of little things I do to jumpstart myself. And I know the listeners can't see this, but I'll show you too, and then I'll explain it. This is a basket full of note cards. And when I write, or when I read rather, and things really interest me, or, you know, I love a quote or something, I'll write it down here, and I keep these. And I use them a few different ways. One is that I will take one in the morning and carry it around during the day, and the shape of it, it may be the syntax, it could be a particular image, it could be the overall meaning of the whole thing will just sort of get into my blood. And then when I sit down to write, like the one I just pulled out is, I am out with lanterns looking for myself. That's Emily Dickinson. Let me see. Only from the heart can you touch the sky. That's Rumi. So I have these here. And sometimes if I'm having trouble getting motivated to write, I'll pull them out and just shuffle through them. And it just inspires me. So I when I find something, I guess what I'm trying to say is, when I find something that inspires me, I try to keep it close and accessible. Whether it's these books that I have on my desk with paintings that I love, or quotes that I want tangibly written down on an actual note card that I can hold. But I try to keep the people and the quotes and the art and the music and everything that inspires me around. So
there's a childlike wonder that you have to have in order to be an artist. And the answer is, like, when you talk about it, and you know, I can see that room that you painted. Like, I want to be in the room with the, you know, that's got the note cards and the books that you like. And when I'm looking at it, but it's like if you could personify your mind outward, you know, that's what it is, surrounded by those trinkets that ultimately that joy, that Christmas belly, as my girlfriend says, that you get excited to be around. You know, I think that when you hold on to that rejuvenating spot, you never get old.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And you never get bored.
Yes. Never. Yeah. Oh, man. No, I can't be bored. I can't. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
So one thing that I'm kind of thinking about here is, with all that we've talked about, one question we haven't asked is, what is it about you helping, you know, new poets or younger poets learn the craft, that what about that is fulfilling for you? I'm asking, what larger work are you doing through that work?
Really, there are so many things, I think, through that, because I think when you are, I'm going to backtrack for a minute and tell you something that I do with a friend in order to step forward and say that. I have a friend, here's another thing that I keep on my desk. These are little accordion pieces of paper. And when I unfold these pieces of paper, each little part has a statement or a question or an image or something that my friend has written on here. And I can't see the next one until I've responded to the first one. So by virtue of simply answering those questions, I've written a poem. And we do that for each other. And but it's an act of generosity in a sense, because there could be something in there that comes more from her mind than my mind that makes it into the poem in a certain way. Or there could be something in a question that I've given her that, if she restates the question, she's written this brilliant thing. And I have to let go of that and say, that's yours now. I gave it to you. And this is part of my creative process, is not feeling, you have to sort of trust, I think, or at least I do have to trust that that the abundance is infinite, and that you don't have to hang on to things. If I start to think that way, then I get stifled and cramped and I can't work. So it's beneficial to me to give whatever I can to other students in terms of my own creativity. And I'm inspired by them. But also, I think that we're all serving the art in whatever way we can. And sometimes I'm serving the art by being the creator. And sometimes I'm serving the art by facilitating someone else's ability to be the creator. And sometimes I'm serving the art by interviewing someone, as you two are doing now. There are so many different ways to serve it. And I think if you really love it, then I think you're grateful to be able to serve it in whatever way you can. So that's part of it. Also, I think that, you know, teaching a like creative writing class, the beginning creative writing class, for instance, creates not only writers, but readers. So like the hairdresser that I mentioned earlier, she may not have become a poet, but she's buying poetry and reading poetry. And I think keeping that alive, keeping the interest in the arts alive in as many ways as you can is really a wonderful thing. And it does make me laugh a little bit to think of this hairdresser out there reading poetry that is probably so inferior to anything that she could have done and being thrilled by it. But she's still appreciating it and engaging with it in some way. And it also helps to create an audience for that work. And yeah. It's just win. There's nothing negative in it in any way, you know?
And you know, I wonder if that hairdresser that you're talking about, you know, in a while, you know, after there's been years spent doing these things, if she might not suddenly find herself writing, even if she never puts anything out, she might find herself writing. Be interesting.
Well, there's a woman that thinks she probably always was, because she was just very talented and skilled. So I would imagine that she's the kind of person who probably called it a diary.
Yeah.
You know? And carried it around and wrote all the time, but just didn't think that it was anything or share it with anyone. And I tried to tell her, you know, this is the cat, but she didn't get it. Oh, what? You're so nice. Thank you.
Well, if she doesn't listen to you, who's she going to listen to? I mean, that's, I think.
She heard you. She heard you.
I think that's a thing, too, that I noticed back, you know, my radio show partner and I started doing this World Poetry Open Mic show 7 years ago at the end of this month. And one of the things we realized was that almost everyone writes at least one poem. And I'm talking car mechanics, trash, you know, whatever. At least they've written at least one. And, you know, it's far more a part of people's lives than I think we realize or that we talk about. And I'm really happy that there's people like you who are there to help them develop that craft when they are serious to step in and to start doing that.
Oh, thank you.
Of course. So if you have, let me just ask this question. We can go on, Cliff, if you have another question after it. But if you could have an ask for anybody who's studying poetry or wants to be a poet, who is serious about taking a step into this world and really trying to do it seriously as work in their life, or a piece of advice you might want to give them, what would you impart?
The first thing that popped into my mind is an incredibly practical thing, and it's not really necessarily an inspiring thing. But I would say, because of the fact that I didn't really realize that you could become a poet, and I also didn't really think at certain points that writing or creativity was necessarily of the value that it is. When I was younger, I thought that I should be doing things like, you know, marching and protests or, you know, other things that were more practical. I would think that, you know, to recognize that it is actually an incredibly important thing, and in a practical sense to treat it as such. And by that, I mean doing things like if you're trying to establish a writing practice, actually write certain days on your calendar, you know, like say every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday from noon until 2 as your writing time on your calendar. And then when somebody asks you, can you do this at noon on Monday, you look at your calendar and say, no, I have an appointment. I mean, you have to treat it that way, like it's as important as anything else. And if you don't get in that habit, I think if you start that way, you can train yourself to where you don't actually have to do that anymore. But at least in the beginning, if you don't do that, then it's very easy. Just like we talked about earlier, how someone will see you vacuuming and think that you're not writing in your head. If you don't start really claiming time for yourself, then you don't ever think of that time as important. So I think that's really the number one thing, starting.
Yep. I think that's a huge piece of advice, and I think it is something that so many people really need to hear, because it's our world. I mean, I had a conversation with someone in the grocery store yesterday, where there were so many different brands of black beans that it was overwhelming, you know, and the idea being that, yes, it's this wonderful thing of having an abundance of options. However, it becomes very stressful. And so when you start having that in your schedule, as so many of us do, unless you consciously carve something out, it almost never happens. And yeah, no, I think that's a very practical piece.
Well, thank you.
Of course. Cliff, do you have anything you want to, I mean, I know we're kind of coming to the end, and I have an ask of both of you before we officially end our thing. So do you have any other questions?
First of all, no, in advance to you, Amadek. No, that's cool. No,
you're going to want to see.
No,
this.
I want to, as we round down, I do want to impress upon people that they need to go out and get I Ate the Cosmos for breakfast. Melissa Studdard sent it to me a while ago, and it sticks with me for all the reasons that I keep bringing it up. It's tangible, and it's imaginative, and it's unique. And then there's a commonality in someone coming out of the better part of a bad place to a wonderful spot. It's a rejuvenating read, and I want to thank you for it. I want to hear from the title, I Ate the Cosmos for Breakfast. That's my last question. What's the story behind that title? Please, it's haunted me because I kind of got a bet with my girlfriend, and I want to see if I'm right. So, I do.
That makes me not want to answer the question.
No.
Be wrong. It's whatever you think it is, and it's whatever.
No, don't do it. Damn it.
No, I can give you an answer, but. Truly, I mean, I don't own it anymore. Once I wrote it and put it out there, we all own it. So whatever I answer is my answer. It's not the right answer anymore. So,
right.
It came from, I can tell you the origin, which is that I was reading Thich Nhat Hanh, the Buddhist philosopher, and I was reading a lot about how what we consume as part of our diet, and this is earlier when you asked me a question and I said, oh, I got hung up on something. I didn't get the question part of the question. It's because when you were talking about eating, I was trying to figure out if you were talking about literally eating food or if you were talking about consuming other things. And so that's where that comes from. I was thinking quite a bit about all the things that we consume, such as media and comments that other people make about us and things that we observe, like the 17,000 different kinds of cans of beans, all of these things that we consume are part of our diet. And that's one of the things that Thich Nhat Hanh talked about. And so that sort of got me thinking about, what happens to us and how do we digest all these things that we consume and I started thinking about how huge it all was. And then it went, of course, to the pancake, which is the, part of the title poem, I Ate the Cosmos for Breakfast. And that's about, the eggs and all the things that went into making the pancake. And I just said, so that's where the title came from.
There's your answer, Cliff.
And for the record, neither one of us were anywhere close. I got real quiet. I'm like, no.
You both lost.
So again, harmony in the universe. Thank you so much, Melissa.
But thank you.
I love, and maybe this is a good place for us to close, but I love the thing that you said, where you said that once you've put it out into the world, it belongs to all of us now. And I love that contribution-minded approach, which I really think it is what it's all about. It's always about creating something of value and then giving it to everyone else. And could you maybe as a close here, speak about what that, how you view that contribution of an artist, of a poet to the rest of the culture?
Can you say a little bit more about what you mean by how I view it?
Yeah. I mean, so I think, at least I was extrapolating, and correct me if I'm wrong, if I'm misinterpreting this, but that when you're creating something and then you put it out, and now it belongs to everyone else. It has now become part of the culture to whatever level that it rises up within it. And it's kind of this idea that artists are continually, as we move forward in time, creating all of these new things and just adding to culture consistently all of the time. And that is really a deeply sacred idea if you get into it. So I guess what I'm asking is, do you spend time consciously thinking about that? And if so, how do you go about thinking about what you put into the world? Do you let do you just kind of open it and the floodgates go, or do you spend time intentionally saying, what am I putting into culture and how will this affect things that I, you know, people who come into contact with it?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you. Because sure. Now I really understand what you're saying. And I would have to say both. I mean, to some degree with some things, I think about at great depth, how will this affect this person or that person, or how will it affect the culture, and what can I do to put something out there that's positive? But having said that, I have to say that I did that when I first began writing to such a degree that I feel that I may have sanitized some things. And I recognize that the human experience is varied and difficult, and we are humans and we make mistakes and we do rude things and we do embarrassing things, and sometimes we do mean things even if we didn't mean to, and all of this is part of the human experience. And at some point I did realize that it's much more helpful to other human beings to witness another person's honesty than to witness them just putting out sort of super, you know, happy, positive things that are going to have a specific kind of effect. So, and I don't know. I mean, sometimes I feel like I may swing a little too far in the direction of openness for my own comfort. There are a couple of poems that I've written recently that I sent out, and then I thought, oh gosh, if they get accepted. you know, because they're just there are a few things that are just really out there. And but I believe also, again, that's another time in which it becomes sort of important to have an artistic community and people you trust who will remind you that you know, that you're doing something important, and that sometimes putting something out there that's honest that may even feel a little embarrassing or raw or something like that is a good thing for other people, and ultimately I think for yourself too, because you're not, I mean, the more we have to like hide things, and the more, you know, shameful it becomes, and then we feel that there's something wrong that maybe really isn't that wrong because like 15,000 other people are reading it going, I knew it, I did that last week, you know. And I love the idea of being that person who makes other people feel like it's okay, you know, to think or feel the things that they feel that they may not have realized before was okay. So I think about it. But ultimately, at some point, I really let go of it and just trust the process and the art. And as you mentioned, the sacredness of, you know, putting my drop in the ocean, and that the ocean will absorb it in the right way.
Both Cliff and I want to say thank you for spending your time with us. We also want to say thank you to Melissa for a fantastic interview. If you want to find Melissa, you can find her at melissastuttered.com. You can find Cliff Brooks at cliffbrooks.com or southerncollectiveexperience.com. And you can find me, Michael Amadei, at michaelamadei.com or worldpoetryopenmic.net. The music for this episode was provided by the fantastic Justin Johnson. You can find him at justinjohnsonlive.com. Until next time, remember to be courageous. Do the hard work. Conquer your obstacles creatively. Learn to trust your heart, for it's easy to lose our path in this business of music and poetry.